little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying.
Well, a very hearty welcome to you all out there. This is Thinking Clearly. This is Bob Frelick. This is a show about critical thinking, and I want to tell you right off the bat that Julia Minton, co-host of this show, is not going to be with us tonight, but she'll be back next month with us on Thinking Clearly. But we do have a very special guest. We have a Facebook page. Just go to the Facebook search bar and type in Thinking Clearly Radio, and you'll get to our Facebook page where we post the links, additional links for additional information about the topics that we talk about. You can also make comments on our Facebook page. Especially, we like to hear from listeners who would request certain topics to be heard in the future on Thinking Clearly. So we want to be as interactive as possible. Another way we do that is that we podcast this show, and you can get to the podcast of any of the shows that we've done on Thinking Clearly by typing into your computer thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's one word, thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. You can also find us on iTunes and various other podcast apps just by typing in Thinking Clearly. I want to review, before we get to our guest, the short version of our working definition for critical thinking. It starts like this. Critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. The upshot of that is that we're logically reasoning from our evidence, which in logic are called premises, to reach our conclusion. So it's an evidence-based approach rather than an approach which kind of appeals to us emotionally or the way we wish the world it would be if it were a perfect world. And that's what this show is all about. Well, there are a lot of related topics to critical thinking, and we've been through a number of those that you'll be able to see if you go to our podcast archive. Well, there's a longer definition. We're not going to get to that tonight because we do have a guest, and I think he's on the line. Before we hear from him, let me introduce the topic. I did, about a month ago, a Google search for the words tribalism and polarization. I did the search such that those two words would have to appear together in whatever you retrieved from Google in order to show up. And I got 52,200 hits. And they had titles like this, articles like this, The Uses of Tribalism in American Politics. And another one was Tribalism Triumphs in America. And, well, I've certainly noticed in just my personal listening and talking to people, I've noticed both of those words appearing more and more often, especially in media communications and other personal conversations. So tonight, we're going to explore those concepts with guest philosopher and podcaster Kevin Delaplante, the second time guest with us on Thinking Clearly. Let me just say a little bit about Dr. Kevin Delaplante. He worked for 16 years thereabouts as an academic philosopher, teaching and serving as the chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Iowa State University. But he chose to leave academia in 2015 to work full-time as an independent educator, speaker, and consultant specializing in critical thinking skills. And his original tutorial courses at the Critical Thinker Academy have been great resources for many of the topics that we've covered on this show. And it's very exciting to have him here as a second-time Skype-in guest tonight. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Bob.
Good to hear your voice. Before we get into it a little bit, Kevin, I do want to remind listeners that we're going to be taking calls later in the show. It's going to be around 7:50 because I think we have a lot to cover tonight, or it might be a tad earlier. We'll see. I will announce it when we open the phone lines for your comments on tonight's topics or questions for Kevin. Well, let's start out, Kevin, by defining tribalism. But right at the start, I want to give a little disclaimer. And that is that we in no way mean to use this word to imply any disrespect for the common use of the word as distinguishing one group of indigenous peoples from another. And actually, and you can check me if I'm right on this, but I looked up the history of the word tribe and origin of it, and it has a long history coming from the Latin tribus. Now, I never took Latin. Am I pronouncing that right, Kevin? Do you know? Tribus?
That sounds right to me.
Sounds pretty good. Denoting one of the three political ethnic divisions in the original Roman state. So it has a long history. And we could probably just as well use the phrase affinity group, but tribe just has a more intuitive and kind of powerful sound to it. So, Kevin, let's start out by letting us know how you define tribe in your usage of the word.
Sure. Thank you. Okay. Yeah. So basically, I call a tribe a group of people that feel connected to each other in a meaningful way, because they share something in common that matters to them. So the connection can be based on just about anything. It can be gender, kinship, ethnicity, religion, culture, sports teams, hobbies, you know, whatever you want. What matters is that this connection binds individuals into a group in such a way that it allows them to make a distinction between us, members of the group, and them, those who are not members of the group. So when I talk about tribalism, I'm really talking about a pattern of attitudes and behaviors that human beings tend to adopt when we come to identify with our tribes. So you could call it human groupishness or social identification, but you know, tribalism seems to be the term that more and more people are using right now to talk about these issues.
All right. And I do want to say that you've done so much work on critical thinking and approached it from a variety of different ways, including the sort of the academic philosopher approach to trying to bring it more and more to life for regular folks who've maybe not taken a lot of philosophy and probably never taken a logic course. But you've kind of migrated away a little bit from some of that, and you got interested because you're now doing some sketchbook-style videos. And your last variety of that were on the issue of tribalism and polarization. What brought you to that? What prompted you to engage with those issues?
Well, I think I should clarify that the name of that particular video series is Tribalism and Critical Thinking, right? So polarization is a recurring theme in this discussion, but my broader motivations have to do with helping people think more clearly and independently for themselves. So that's the critical thinking mandate there. But from that perspective, though, it's easy to see why tribalism is important for critical thinking. It's an important part of human nature that has a big impact on our ability to think critically. And right now, as you mentioned in the intro, you can't go a day without seeing an article or a pundit talking about tribalism in the context of politics or the media. I saw a quote the other day in a review of Amy Chua's new book called Political Tribes, where the reviewer says something like, "The single most important intellectual trend of our time is the popular rediscovery of human tribalism." So that's quite a quote. So my goal with these videos was to develop a resource that would help people develop a certain level of tribal literacy, a basic working knowledge of how our tribal psychology affects our beliefs and attitudes and how we view ourselves and our relationship to people inside and outside our tribes, and to treat that as a critical thinking resource. That's the ultimate goal of this.
Can you go ahead and at this point and just go ahead and elaborate on that a little bit? Because how does a knowledge of tribal dynamics or tribal psychology, how does that help us as critical thinkers?
Sure. Well, the basic idea behind tribal psychology, or what I'm calling tribal psychology, is that we use the us-them distinction defined by tribal boundaries to make normative judgments, judgments about what's right or wrong or good or bad in some respect. I know you guys talk about that enough on the show that your audience knows what a normative judgment is. So we're good, they're bad. We're right, they're wrong. We're worthy, they're unworthy. We're the rational ones, they're irrational. Our beliefs are true, their beliefs are false. A lot of people have written about how moral psychology is tribal. I think Jonathan Haidt, you know, it comes to mind. But it's also important to see how much of our, what I call our epistemic psychology, is also tribal. And by epistemic psychology, I mean those aspects of our psychology that determine how we judge what beliefs are justified or not justified, or what arguments are persuasive or not persuasive, or who we regard as rational or irrational. So when I talk about tribal psychology, I'm thinking in terms of this combination of our moral psychology and our epistemic psychology, where the tendency is to favor our tribe, our in-group, and to dismiss or diminish the views of those outside our tribe. So that's clearly relevant to the goals of critical thinking, right? If we're all prone to doing this, then we have to understand this about ourselves so that we can have like a fighting chance of managing or debiasing or do whatever we can to help to mitigate the problems that that can arise from this.
So is it almost as if we're identifying very strongly with some particular tribe that we adopt the belief of that tribe and we don't search for the truth through a process like critical thinking?
Well, I mean, it's a host of, I think, psychological mechanisms that are tied up with the benefits of tribal identification. So one kind of mechanism I talked about in one of my videos is that it functions like a filter. We filter information about various issues by checking, in some sense, whether or not how the issue bears on values and commitments of our dominant tribal groups. So that sets up a kind of context for motivated reasoning, kind of tribal-oriented motivated reasoning. That's a broad, you know, description. But I can talk more in detail about some of these, you know, some of the examples I talked about in the videos. The variety of ways in which it affects our thinking, I think, is quite profound, really. I mean, the more I learn about this, the more I'm struck by that it really does require a shift in our understanding of human nature to come to appreciate all this properly, that we're just how social creatures we are and how much of our cognition, our thinking, is in fact socially and culturally dependent as well.
So it's almost as if this idea of tribalism, I hate to say contaminates, but it affects the process of actually, in an unbiased way, looking for evidence and then reasoning to a conclusion. Am I overstating that, or is that one way of thinking about this?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, if you want, I can talk about some of the specific,
Yeah, why don't you do that? Because I think one of the things that I remember is that sometimes, well, before we do that, let's help the listeners anchor this idea of tribe, for example. Could you give some examples of what kinds of tribes we're really talking about that our listeners might be able to relate to?
Well, sure. I mean, they come in, almost any social cue can be used to trigger a tribal impulse, actually, as long as it's a cue that distinguishes one group from another and there's some meaningful or salient relationship going on there. But the most usual ones we talk about are political and social categories, like liberal versus conservative, far left, centrist, far right, Democrat, Republican, you know, feminist or non-feminist or anti-feminist, capitalist versus socialist, atheist, non-atheist, open borders versus closed borders, you know, male, female, black, white, immigrant, non-immigrant, rich, poor, you know, all those, you know, new fan of the new Star Wars, fan of the old Star Wars. Those are all, you know, political, social, cultural categories that form part of our identities. So for each of these, they form part of our social identity, and we all, you know, participate in multiple overlapping social identities that have tribal aspects to them. Some of them are more dominant than others. Political, you know, my preference for old Star Wars versus new Star Wars may be, you know, not as salient, right, as my to my identity as feeling that I'm sort of liberal versus conservative. And so all of those are the kind of things that I'm sure your audience is very aware of, how they identify across this spectrum of categorizations.
Listeners might think about the last time you were with an extended family at a gathering and conversations began brewing, especially political conversations. And one group of people started bringing up, well, maybe Amy Goodman in Democracy Now! Says this kind of thing. And the other group is talking about something that they heard on Fox News. And it begins to almost, you can see it happening. I've had this experience at a dinner. And you could almost see people starting to gather together in little groups based on what the conversation was and what they were expressing. So that may be one way for people to think about this. Why don't you go ahead, and you were going to talk a little bit more about some of the details involved in this tribal psychology.
Yeah. So I mean, do you want to talk about, say, about the adaptive advantages or the evolutionary backstory of this, or do you want to talk about?
Sure, because otherwise we may give folks the idea after the show that this whole idea of tribalism is has no upside, has no advantages. It's just all bad, and we don't want to do that. We want to put it in the context of I think our evolutionary development.
Yeah. So I agree. I think this perspective is helpful, at least for grounding a further discussion. Okay. So on this topic, I think the central idea is that there's no doubt that a lot of this psychological machinery is related to human groupishness and the fact that our Homo sapiens ancestors survived and flourished because we learned how to work together in groups to achieve our collective goals. Now, there's some debate about the right way to think of the evolutionary mechanisms that are responsible for these traits, but I think the big picture is pretty clear, and I think it's a fascinating picture. So just to look at our moral psychology, to keep it kind of simple, we know that in order to work together successfully in groups, individuals need an incentive to cooperate and not just pursue their own narrow self-interest and freeload off of the efforts of other people. Now, there's a whole bunch of evolutionary mechanisms that have helped to solve this problem, the problem of cooperation within groups. There's kin selection that explains why we're willing to sacrifice for the benefit of genetically related family members. There's reciprocal altruism. It's a version of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. That explains why we're willing to sacrifice for the benefit of unrelated members of our tribe that we're likely to encounter over and over again in a social setting. But there's still this puzzle, because human beings are really an ultra-social species. We build cities with tens of thousands of people. We fight in huge armies. We find ways of cooperating even with strangers within our group. And that trait is likely a product of competition between groups, where cultural evolution is also a factor, not just genetic evolution. So which groups are most likely to survive in a head-to-head competition or a competition for space and resources? That's the question. And the answer has to be that the groups that have higher levels of within-group cohesion and cooperation are going to outcompete groups that have less of that.
And also another factor, it seems, that's prevalent here is that times have changed. We're dealing with a lot more complex, technologically advanced issues now than we used to be when tribes were maybe to the great benefit of our species.
Right. So this psychology, which might have been really adaptive at some point in the past, is going to have some issues today. That moral psychology encourages in-group solidarity, and it encourages hostility toward the out-group. that combination is actually adaptive from a group survival perspective. But unfortunately, that very same moral psychology aggravates the problem that we're facing today, which is how to facilitate cooperation between groups. That's the challenge, right? Or how to extend our moral sympathies to people outside of our group as well. So that it's this tragic irony that the very same psychology that enables us to cooperate and sacrifice and act morally within our groups makes it very hard to do the same outside of our groups. And that, in some ways, that's the problem of tribalism in a nutshell, that our natural inclination is to be very nice to our tribal group and not very nice to outside groups.
So tribalism builds solidarity within the group, but can be alienating in terms of between-group interaction.
Absolutely.
I think there are some studies, too, that talk about when there is that hostility or alienation of the other, that it actually strengthens in-group solidarity.
Right, right. It is. It is. It looks like, I mean, there's some evidence that there's a region of our brain, for example, that lights up when, if you show people images of someone getting hurt and you tell them that, and this is for have like, if you align as a Democrat and you have Democrat and Republican, you tell them that the other person is a Republican and you're a Democrat and they hurt, if something happens to them, that's this misfortune. There's a pleasure center in our brain that lights up when the person on the out group is hurt. So there's like a Schadenfreude unit in our brain, you know, that that takes some pleasure in the misfortune or when someone in the outgroup loses.
And that phenomenon can happen very early in life, too. I think there's some studies on very young children that show that same effect. To some extent, maybe our brain may be wired in that way or to facilitate that sort of action.
Right, right. What's heartening about this is that the attributes that we attach tribal identity to are very flexible. Right? So what's hardwired seems to be the disposition to categorize human beings into in-groups and out-groups. Mm-hmm. But on the basis of what? It looks like things like racial categories or religious categories are not hardwired. In fact, you can intervene in experimental situations where you can get people to shift their alliances very easily, mixing up groups that were otherwise segregated. But as long as you have some kind of tribal identifier to reform the groups in a different along different alignments, then so that's a good that's a hopeful thing, that if we have particularly damaging partisan alignments that have these tribal identities baked in, it's heartening that there might be ways of intervening in social environments to reconfigure those social, you know, and psychological attitudes.
Are there other salient points that you'd like to bring up at this point?
Well, you'd asked me a question about signaling.
Yeah.
Earlier on, mm-hmm. Did you want to talk about signaling?
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. So this is something that I'm gradually coming to appreciate more just recently, maybe in the past like year or so, how much of our behavior may actually reflect an unconscious incentive to reassure our tribe that we're still members in good standing. So there's a lot of interesting work on signaling, what's called signaling, in the economics literature and the evolutionary biology literature, which focuses on when the messages that we communicate are honest or misleading. And when we're talking about tribal signaling, I think the important context to remember is that human beings in isolation are extremely vulnerable. We really do rely on our groups for material and social support that is vital to our physical well-being and our psychological health. So if groups that we identify with are defined in part by an ideological orientation, a view about, you know, the best way to live, then we have to appreciate that there's a significant risk involved in expressing views that run counter to your tribal orientation. If you're no longer perceived as a member in good standing, as an ideologically supportive member of the group, you risk ostracism and you risk losing the benefits of group membership, which really are substantial and important for us. And another thing is that part of tribal signaling involves reinforcing the us-them thinking that favors the in-group and diminishes the out-group. So, for example, if you're on Twitter or Facebook, and you're more likely to engage with people or share content in a way that reinforces these patterns of tribal thinking. You're more likely to share that mocking, one-sided article or that, you know, inflammatory meme, because doing so reinforces your status within your tribal group. You're signaling to your own group. But people almost never think that that's the reason why they're doing it. So in that respect, it can function like kind of unconscious cognitive bias. And I've come to appreciate just how pervasive this mechanism actually is.
I think this will hit home with our local listening audience, because this is a fairly rural community, and rural communities tend to have a lot of community meetings. And there's been, in the last 10, 15 years, a number of kind of major issues in this community with a lot of meetings centered around that. And if you want to talk about signaling, you want to tune into signaling, think about those community meetings. Who chooses to get up and say what? And who holds back? You know, even though they may be, their beliefs may be running counter to what's being expressed. Think of the times in your mind that you've thought, should I say what I really think in this group? And and that's what we're talking about when we're talking about signaling, right?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's not a strange situation to feel like you've pressure to not be honest in a group, you know.
Yeah.
Situation. What's less obvious is that general problem setup might go back, has a long evolutionary history as well. So it may well be that we have psychological mechanisms built into the way we think, who we identify. Part of the reason why we're so disposed to this kind of behavior in a tribal context is because doing so was actually advantageous for our survival and ancestral populations.
Sure. We know that uncivil behavior is on the rise in America, and that's been documented pretty well by an often quoted annual poll, which is conducted by Weber Shandrick and Powell Tate. We talked about that on this show when we talked about civil dialogues. But is there actual empirical evidence that the phenomenon of tribalism is indeed on the rise in America and other places?
I think probably we want to distinguish tribalism from polarization, because I think that distinction actually is very important, that I'm inclined to want to talk about the rise of polarization.
Okay,
polarization.
Let's get into what polarization is and compare and contrast the two.
Sure. Yeah, I called the first video in my series The Dangers of Tribalism, but you know, a more accurate title might have been The Dangers of Polarization. Because I really do think that the problem isn't tribalism per se, but rather what tribalism becomes when polarization becomes excessive. So let's draw the distinction. Tribalism is this collection of attitudes and behaviors that we're prone to adopt when we identify with social groups. Polarization is a measure of distance or separation between groups along some dimension. How far apart are the groups? Metaphorically speaking. So I think the evidence is clear that actually a moderate amount of polarization is actually quite good for us. We reap the benefits of group membership. You get a sense of belonging, of social cohesion, social support, while still having enough common ground with members of other groups that respectful communication is still possible. If polarization is moderate, we can still imagine having long-term friendships with people who may lie outside our dominant cultural group. But when polarization ratchets up, that domain of common ground shrinks more and more, and it becomes harder and harder to view people in other groups as rational equals who are still good people, but with whom we just happen to disagree on some issues. We start to view people on the other side as irrational or morally lacking in some important way. And then when you really crank up the polarization, that sets up the conditions for the worst kind of behavior that human beings are capable of, you know, violence, discrimination, cruelty. So I don't think the question isn't how do we get rid of tribalism. That's not possible. The question is, how do we de-escalate a cultural climate that is overly polarized? And or how do we prevent the continuous ratcheting and escalation that seems to be the condition that we're facing right now? I think that's the problem.
Very good. I don't want to take you off track on this, but I'm just going to throw this at you. It was something I was thinking about when I was thinking about tribalism and polarization. I don't want to spend a long time with it, but I wonder if there's a connection between incremental change, political change, versus social revolution or political revolution and polarization.
Is the question whether there's something
to think about.
A connection between those?
Yeah. In other words, I was thinking that in some instances, there's going to be some people in a political system who are going to push for polarization because their theory of change is more, we need a complete change. We need a revolution. So we want to polarize, whereas some other people who believe that the incremental change is safer, probably more lasting, more apt to yield over the long run something that's good rather than something that can be unpredictable and bad. And I'm wondering if there's a relationship there or if you've thought about that.
Well, you know, I think it's helpful to distinguish two different types of polarization. One is ideological polarization. Mm-hmm. That's where you imagine people differing strongly on their political arguments or their political views. So if I have a strongly liberal versus strongly conservative, you know, ideological space, then we can differ in that respect. But then there's this kind of social polarization that has to do with is how culturally similar or dissimilar people feel they are to one another. So when social polarization is high between groups, the symptoms of this is that people just don't like each other. They don't trust each other. They don't empathize with each other. They don't want to be around each other. Their cultural distance is such that they have a hard time relating to the other group, and they view them with suspicion. And that can have nothing, that doesn't have to have anything much to do with ideological differences. It can be driven. So one driver of political change can be groups that actually arise and have strongly differing ideological views about the best way to live. So that can be a driver of polarization. But the sense in which people start to like hate each other, or don't trust each other, or don't want to spend time with each other, is a kind of social polarization. And that has to do, and that's about social identity, cultural identity. That's a much more disturbing trend, I think, because mm-hmm. that's the one that we're seeing. The trend in the US, for example, has been a trend that way. There's been some, you know, from the 1950s onward to now, over this 50-year period, there's been increasing polarization between Democrats and Republicans. Ideologically, there's been some split, but there's much more social polarization. So, for example, studies show that Americans today prefer to spend their social time with members of their own political party. So I'm thinking here, I'm talking Brett out, simply knowing that someone is a Democrat when you're a Republican or vice versa, and you're a partisan, that you identify with your political tribe. There was a time, you know, not that long ago, when there was much more intermixing of people with different political orientations. Now we're much more segregated. We're much more segregated in this respect.
Sounds like you're talking about Congress.
Well, I'll tell you, it's shocking when this is the results of surveys of ordinary people. They don't want their close friends to be members outside of their political in-group. They don't want to live next door to members of the opposing party. They don't want to marry or have their kids marry members of the opposing party. This is kind of newish, these stats from, you know, recent trends. There's been these decades-long shifts that I think are responsible for this, but this kind of stronger animosity are empirical measures of social polarization. When told that members of the opposing political party live in their neighborhood, people express less satisfaction with living in that neighborhood, even if they don't know who these people are. People don't want their party leaders to compromise anymore. They're more likely to blame the other party for all the incivility we see in government. There's also been an increase in people's help when they respond, do you feel proud about being a member of your political party? There's been an increase in that. So that kind of social polarization is mostly about cultural shifts, I think. The ideological differences are, in some ways, they don't explain those shit, because when you survey people on their ideological differences, there are some differences, but they're not nearly the magnitude of these social ones. The person who studied this phenomenon the most is Lillian Mason. She's a political scientist at University of Maryland, I think, and she has a book out now called Uncivil Agreement. It's all about this, and it's kind of fascinating. And her view is that the cause of all this has to do with social segregation. It's that we're spending a lot less time with people in these different cultural groups. Yeah. It's shocking, for example, how different like Democrats and Republicans have socially segregated themselves over the past 40 years.
Yeah.
Now, for example, Democrats and Republicans drive different kinds of cars. They drink different kinds of beer. They drink different kinds of soft drinks. They watch different sports. They live and work in different environments. They don't go to the same churches. And they're religiously segregated and racially segregated. This alignment of social identities into the groups is the new phenomenon that's happened over the past, 30, 40 years.
It's the echo chamber effect.
And it means that when we do get together, when we mix in social environments or in our work or something, we have nothing to talk about. Mm-hmm. We're not culturally similar enough to have comfortable conversations.
The other thing that makes me think is that getting back to the effects on critical thinking is that if we're not talking to the other groups of people who have different beliefs than us, then how are we ever going to challenge our own arguments and get new information that might challenge our beliefs and help us angle towards the truth?
Yeah. This is what Jonathan Haidt calls viewpoint diversity, mm-hmm. right? Important element of critical thinking. And when we socially segregate and tribalize, we reduce viewpoint diversity. And it's a problem. Yeah. But it's also a problem from like a moral psychology stance, right? Because if I don't, one of the effects of this kind of social segregation is that I literally don't run into Republicans. Right? Let's say I'm a Democrat or I lean liberal. I'm much less likely now to encounter and have to socialize with conservative Republicans on a daily basis than I was 30, 40 years ago, mm-hmm. which means I don't know what their lives are like and they don't know what my life is like, right? And that breeds lack of empathy and a feeling of you're very different from me. You're culturally other from me.
Well, here comes I think we've done a good job of painting the picture of the problems involved. Here's the $64 question or $64,000 question. What can be done to change this, to foster more productive relationships between these in groups that are becoming polarized?
Well, the short answer to that is if we together in the show could come up with an answer to that,
we could patent it.
We could patent it. We'd be rich. We'd be famous, right? So this is a very difficult problem. You know, laying out the problem like we have, we're fighting both. You're fighting innate psychology, all the adaptive psychological mechanisms that we inherit. You know, that are part of how our brains work. And we're fighting broad social and cultural trends that individuals have a hard time knowing how to fight against. Like, if you start to track the social sorting that's happened, it's just in the U.S. context from 1950 onward. If like Lillian Mason is right, and this is causally a driver of the social polarization we've seen. Well, those are broad demographic and sociological trends that have a history. You just can't go back and unwind those, right? You can't. We don't have the power to intervene in society to force people to live together and interact more. But that would be one. I mean, probably the most obvious example, if you had all the power in the world, is that apply some version of what's called contact theory in social psychology. It's where, you know, certain kinds of social contact can function to reduce prejudice between groups, getting people together under certain conditions so that they experience what the each other's lives are like. All of a sudden, social attitudes change. This has been studied for decades, right? You can engineer that in a lab context, but socially, what we're asking is that we want to find ways to encourage more sort of cross-cutting social contact between people of different backgrounds and groups. And it's really hard to know exactly how to do this.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, other approaches that we can take to this problem.
Yeah, and some of that comes out when you're really exploring having civil dialogues, in that attempts to find common ground, attempts to what they call steel man the other person's argument, which is right. To listen to their argument and present it back to the person in the strongest form, the opposite of strawmanning somebody's argument, taking something that's a weak part of their argument and knocking it down like a straw man. So, they're, you know, steel manning, asking questions, attempting to isolate common values are all ways of maybe making an attempt to do this and doing it with empathy. So there's some overlap between what we're talking about and having civil dialogue. So I don't think either one of us question, and probably our listening audience don't either, that it is a problem, but it is something that we can work on individually. And maybe when we get to the opening the phone lines, which will come up in a couple minutes here, our listeners can give us some ideas about what we can do about this polarization and how we can foster more productive relationships between groups. What I want to ask you now is what's ahead for you and your projects, and how can folks find you and support your work?
Well, thank you for asking. So I'm working on these tribal videos. So my website is kevindelaplante.com. I know you've been very generous in sharing that URL on your show. I appreciate that very much. Sometimes I see little spikes in the signups at the Critical Thinker Academy, and I think maybe it's people who were listening to the show. I don't know. some people can see me, my home site there, which is my sort of home base. The Argument Ninja podcast is where I'm producing shows that, you know, are me working through my thoughts on these issues about the nature of critical thinking and the application of, you know, the psychology of decision and belief formation and persuasion to these broader problems of how to think critically. But as you've also talked about on your show, I'm interested in designing training programs that really develop critical reasoning and persuasive communication skills as skills. And so that's a sort of a longer term goal that requires that I be able to, you know, or those are innovative instructional design projects that I'm still trying to get, you know, started. Part of it is having to get, finances aligned in a way that allows me to do these more ambitious projects. Right now I'm working on a video course, actually, on the philosophy of science that your audience might be interested in when it's done. I'm teaching right now a course at Carleton University here in Ottawa on the philosophy of science. I did the early summer session here, and I'm designing a video course based on the content of that class. So people might be interested in that. It's a good introduction to issues in science literacy, the vocabulary of science, and a good jumping off point for issues in the philosophy of science.
Very good. And I'm going to give out the numbers now, and you can call in. And if you have questions, if you have answers for us about how we can make this more, this
That's
polarization
right.
more productive.
We want you to call in with
yes,
answers.
We want some answers.
Please.
But if you do have questions for Kevin De La Plante, and I do want to spell your name so that folks can do a search for you. And I think we do have a caller already. We'll take that in just a minute. But I do want to spell Kevin De La Plante. Well, it's Kevin, K-E-V-I. And the last name is spelled D-E-L-A-P-L-A-N-T-E. And Argument Ninja is just argument, and it's N-I-N-J-A. So those searches, and I will put links on our Facebook page to them. But those will get you hooked up with Kevin's work, and I encourage listeners to pursue that. So I think we do have a caller, a couple of callers, so let's take the first caller. Hello, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you. I heard it said that the word tribe has been replaced with the word group, that the Native Americans would prefer to that people use the word group rather than tribe. I did listen to your program, and I met no criticism at all because I may be talking about something else because your arguments were airtight. So I don't mean any criticism, just the word, just a comment, a note. And I have no ideas. well, I do have some ideas. I think that President Trump is not very presidential. I don't think he's been good for this country. What's happening now is really not that great, although there have been people saying that it's been building in a way, but what's going on right now is really not that good. And there's a growing incivility. You're so right. This guy turned around yesterday at the library and hit me really hard in the forearm, and I couldn't tell you whether it was intentional or not.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Kevin, do you have any responses to what the caller has talked about?
Well, I'm very sympathetic to the concern that we are this very important conversation is using a term that a cultural group has been calling themselves for a long time, First Nations, especially in Canada, for example, here, we call them First Nations peoples or First Nations tribes. And so I'm sure that if I was giving a talk in front of that audience, I would not speak this way. I think it would just be really uncomfortable. I wish the problem with language choices is that you have to engage with a broader audience of people who are having a conversation. So there's the language which is ongoing, and then do you have good substitutes? Groups is so generic, right? That it doesn't. See, you're gonna have to put a whole bunch of adjectives or qualifiers in front of the word group to carry the same set of connotations that we're using with this concept of tribe. But there might be a better term for it. Certainly don't mind the idea of looking for a better term.
Well, I think the psychologists use the term affinity group, not tribalism or tribes. Thank you very much, caller. It is interesting, though, that talking about what causes that, what's caused the tribalism, and that the caller was noting the president and the election and that sort of thing, and that may be a factor. And you mentioned Amy Chua, who's a Yale professor, wrote the book The Political Tribes, and I heard an interview on Book TV with her, and she was asked that question, what's causing, what do you think is causing the resurgence of tribalism? And she said that there's always been tribalism in America, but that because the majority in power, she said, wealthy white man, controlled the message and that those more tribal narratives were just stifled, but says now that with the changing demographics, that that is changing. So that she attributed the rise of tribalism in terms of the change of demographics, at least in the United States.
Yeah, and that's certainly going to change the that's one of the silver linings. I mean, people who are unhappy with the current political situation can be consoled in some way that the march of demographic change, as these demographic bubbles move through and grow, right? We're going to have white minority states, you know, appearing on a clockwork schedule mm-hmm. over the next 10, 15, 20 years, right? So there's just no way that to stop that. And it may well be that you're going to get political realignments that are a response to those changes, which help to diffuse maybe some of the issues. For example, it might be a good thing if the Republican Party splits, you know, to help, you know, sort out what these new alignments are.
Yeah. Interesting times we're living in. Let's take the next caller. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Well, thank you, and thank you ever so much for this program, Bob. I really have found this more engaging and more informative than much of the stuff that I hear on the radio. And what is the name now of Kevin DuPlant's book here?
He doesn't have a book out yet that I know
okay,
of.
Okay, that's
no,
why
I do not have a book.
Kevin, tell him how to connect with your work.
Yeah, so I was a philosopher working in the university system for a long time, but now I'm on my own. I produce these online video courses and I have a site called the criticalthinkeracademy.com. I have a podcast where at argumentinjured.com, which you can also find at my home site, which is kevindelplant.com. But so I've been making a living basically doing a variety of things related to online teaching, speaking, and consulting. But I don't have a book. I would love to have a book. I have two or three book ideas, certainly, that I would love if I had the time and the base to do it. I've got a bunch in mind.
Well, you've got lots of time, Kevin. You're a young man.
I'm a young man.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm an old man, and I'm used to getting things out of books where I can stop and go back over a paragraph two or three times and put it down with a bookmark in it if I find my attention not focusing anymore. So I love to have things in books, but I'll get this wherever I can take it. I found what you have to say extremely informative and very well presented. And I do hope to hear more from you. And thank you, Bob, for locating this person.
Yeah,
okay. I'm getting off here so other people can talk.
Okay, great. Thank you for the call. And do we have another caller? All right. So we've got
cheers for Bob.
and Kevin. Yeah, maybe that call will stimulate you to write an article anyway that the listener can actually get to and enjoy. Kevin, why don't you just take a minute? We only have less than a minute left, but take 30 seconds or so to wrap up a little bit and invite folks to enjoy your work.
Sure. I guess the only thing I'll say to wrap up is that I am I'm going to continue this video series that I'm doing on tribalism and critical thinking. And some of the things that I've had up the top of my head, you know, with this conversation here are because I'm doing research for future videos, and I'm trying to get a sense of the size of the problem, its various aspects, and I think I have a handle on at least one part of the stuff we talked about in this show is part of that story. But I think there's a broader story to be told about the different types of forces that are playing a role in exacerbating or reinforcing the kind of tribalism and polarization that we've seen, and I'm going to be laying those out in greater detail in subsequent videos. So I'm just going to invite people to follow me if they can and stay tuned for that.
And I'll give them all the links on our Facebook page. Thank you very much, Kevin DeLaplante, for being with us here on Thinking Clearly.
It was my great pleasure, Bob. Thank you so much.
Okay. And thank you very much, Eric Allen, for a great job of engineering. Keep thinking clearly.
Think for yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, people-powered radio.